Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine, and today we have Mike Fave back. Actually changed his name to Mike Favorite. Actually, oh my God, my dog just walked in the room and she's eating a tortilla chip really loudly. Thanks, Dita. I was super selfish with Mike because sometimes we have guests and they just end up giving me like a free consultation. Is that rude? I don't know. It was amazing. And so when we start this episode, we start right in. You're catching us talking about my inability to break down fructose now that I'm in menopause. Yeah. You know, don't let anybody tell you that menopause is not a wrecking ball, because it is. And I think that if I hadn't been working on my gut for so many years and my health and, you know, getting active and doing all the right things, I think it would be much worse. And so I'm really grateful that I was on top of this beforehand and that I know progesterone well. For those of you who are new or who haven't heard me talk about this, I actually got off of progesterone and melatonin, and you know, I was taking pregnenolone, just got off all the hormones because I am kind of doing a little study. I'm doing Georgie Dinkoff's hair steroid analysis. I'm doing a Dutch. I'm doing a blood spot for Moment. I'm doing a 24-hour urine and a full blood panel for everything. And we're going to see, and I'm going to do them all on the same day. And we're going to see exactly what's going on with hormones as a woman enters into menopause. I know I'm just one woman, but it's going to be pretty interesting. And Georgie Dinkoff's going to use it also for his studies that he's doing with his steroid analysis work. So that's really cool. But so this is an exciting episode because it's not just about me and my inability to break down fructose. It's about men's health. And that is new. It's all about testosterone and metabolic stuff for men. So it's really exciting. Mike is the bomb guest. He is so good. And yeah, so just take notes, get your brothers and your uncles and your spouses and your boyfriends and your nephews, all everybody, get them to listen to this because they're going to learn a lot about their bodies. All right, enjoy Mike Favorite.
Yeah, in my experience, watermelon, especially in larger volumes, because it has it does have FODMAPs and it does have an imbalanced glucose to fructose ratio, you can find that it can give you gut symptoms, but those can manifest as like throat irritation or rashes, or like for me, watermelon, just like straight change in stool pattern, like loose stools, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'll get my scalp will start to get itchy after eating that specifically. So those are things that I would keep in mind as the FODMAP thing. And it may not necessarily be candida, but it's just, when you have that imbalanced glucose to fructose ratio and the fructose and the FODMAPs, I think it's fructans is what the watermelon has. When those stay inside the intestinal tract, then the bacteria get a hold of them. Then you can start to get the production of the different metabolites. So in like the fructose feeding studies, I know you wanted to talk about some of those, but they find like really high concentrations of endotoxin in the rat's portal veins after they feed them pure fructose, because they don't absorb all the fructose. And then since it's just pure fructose, the bacteria get a hold of it and then they start producing different metabolites from it. And the same thing can kind of happen with the FODMAP or the imbalanced glucose to fructose fruits. So apples is another one. Like apple juice usually gives people symptoms as well. And it's because it's high in sorbitol and then it's high in fructose. So that can cause those symptoms pretty directly. And it does suck because, I mean, I love watermelon too.
That is really upsetting news, but I think you definitely just cracked that. Because I was also thinking, I was talking to Dr. Tyler Panzer about that as well, like an inability to break down fructose properly, or is this something going on in my liver with fructose? And Yeah, that sounds like it could be the answer, because that apple juice does the same, and pineapple juice.
Go ahead.
No, that's it.
Oh, the pineapple juice is a little different. The pineapple juice, depending on how it's made, if it's not pasteurized, it can have bromelain. And bromelain for some people can be irritating because it's a proteolytic enzyme. And I think depending on the structure of your mucosa, like how the proteins in your mucosa are arranged, it can cause some like breakdown. So I know people who will eat pineapple fresh, and they get like the insides of their mouth get like little sores and things like that. That's bromelain. But for me, I can slam pineapple and I never have any sores or anything like that. And I think it's just the difference in the structure. And some people are okay with it, some people aren't. Then with the juice, if the juice is pasteurized, it can still have a degree of a serotonin content. So some people will find that they'll get the runs from it. And I think that's more serotonin because the pineapple doesn't have any FODMAPs, and it has a balanced glucose to fructose ratio. Whereas watermelon, apples, pears, they're imbalanced glucose to fructose, and then they also have FODMAPs. The other thing is the tolerance to fructose without glucose is variable. So you have some people can only have like 5 extra grams of fructose in a meal before they'll get digestive symptoms from it, whereas other people can get upwards of 50. And so that's very individual tolerant. And it's not that your liver isn't processing or anything, is that the transport for glucose across the intestine requires, or the transport for fructose across the intestine requires glucose. They co-transport together. There is a GLUT5 receptor or a transporter that pulls fructose, but it gets saturated really quick in humans. So usually you need both glucose and fructose. And that's another reason why the fructose studies, where they like inject fructose in the people's veins, or they like just pure fructose, or they give them high doses of fructose, don't make any sense, because you're not really getting like a massive bolus of fructose that you could get in without glucose under normal circumstances, because you have the co-transport. So that is changing the circumstance that you're looking for. Plus, you'll
And that's
never see.
those people
Go
who
ahead.
are always like, fructose is poison. It's usually because they're referring to those studies, right?
Yeah. So then there's rat studies where they give them pure fructose, and they find like the whole aberrations that you see Dr. Richard Johnson talk about, which is like the depletion of ATP, then the formation of like AMP, and then you get the uric acid and whatnot, and all like those things trigger all of these different problems. But when you have fructose with glucose in human studies, looking at high doses of fructose or even in like combination, you actually don't see those same problems. And some of those studies were even tested on like diabetics and people with obesity. So it's really high amounts of free fructose without any glucose injected into the bloodstream is a problem. Number one, you would never see that, because any fructose that comes into the system goes directly to the liver. So the actual amount of fructose that is in the bloodstream remains extremely small, like all the time. You never get really high concentrations. So all the things where people talk about, oh, fructose and glycation and this and that, yeah, maybe it does glycate more than some other substrate, but you won't get it in high concentrations in the blood. So like it's kind of a non-argument to some extent. Then the other piece is with the intestine. Most sources of carbohydrate or sugars are fructose and glucose together. So you usually get both together. And then the largest problem is that the ability to absorb fructose is variable amongst people. So if you have like this, if you're going to get like a 75 gram dose of pure fructose, you're going to have a large portion of people who are just not going to absorb most of it if it's in isolation. And then you have the problem of bacterial metabolites that confound the picture. So those are things that kind of make the fructose argument shaky. The other thing is that if you take fructose from fruit, there is not any research to support that that causes metabolic issues. Like there's no strong study showing like, oh, these people, we gave them a bunch of fruit and they developed really high uric acid levels or things like that. And then I have the pleasure of working with people on high sugar diets and getting to see their lab work all the time. So I don't, even for my own, like I've never had a high uric acid value. and I've eaten between 300 to 500 grams of sugar a day. So that's the equivalent of, since it is all sugar, anywhere from 150 to 250 grams of fructose a day. And I haven't gotten obese. I haven't developed high uric acid levels. I don't have any gout, none of those problems. If anything, I don't do well with starches. So I'll find that I get like brain fog after eating. And we could talk about why that happens if you want. Okay. But those are the, like the because it's coming from fruit, 100% fruit, dried fruit, fruit juice, things along those lines, the polyphenolic compounds inside the fruit and the juice actually inhibit some of the negative metabolic processes and some of the lipogenic enzymes that would take sugar and convert it to fats. And then they also help to optimize the utilization of those carbohydrates. And then vitamin C itself helps to helps with the metabolism of uric acid. So at higher vitamin C contents, you can actually lower uric acid using pharmacologic doses of vitamin C and things like that.
Oh, so wow. You're getting, So for gout, that would be an option to go into that sort of high dose vitamin C land.
So using vitamin C with somebody with gout could be helpful for sure. Mm-hmm. With the gout stuff though, there's usually like, cause you have a couple things going on. You have like an increased production of uric acid, and then you can also have like issues with breaking down that uric acid. And so it's trying to figure out which is the areas that are having that problem. Is there problems with the kidney? Is there problems with the liver? Is there stuff going on in the microbiome that's taxing the liver? Usually gout you see in, I think the demographic that you tend to see is like 40 to 50 year old men who are like quite overweight and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't think it's just like fructose. There's like a whole derangement going on with the processing of the carbohydrate. And I even have people who have high uric acid values. Like I work with some people who are like kidney failure or who have like significant liver problems or things along those lines. And they'll have high uric acid values, but they're not really eating that much carbohydrate, and they're definitely not eating that much sugar. And it's because there's metabolic aberration going on that's leading to the either impaired processing of the uric acid, or there's problems at the liver or kidney or something like that. And that's triggering it, not necessarily that it's just all the sugar that they were eating. So there's more to the picture than just the fructose causes uric acid to raise, and then there's gout. Now, to be fair, Dr. Richard Johnson papers don't actually make a case against fruit, but they do make a case against like high fructose intakes from isolated sugar sources.
Okay, interesting. So with a watermelon, how would that look if you wanted to like increase the glucose? What would you add, or how could you balance that better, or just don't eat as much?
Well, so the FODMAPs are always going to be a problem with the watermelon. Mm-hmm. Cause those are like a FODMAP is.
So for people, the fermentable oligosaccharide, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. Polyols?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So those are just, they are carbohydrates, but we don't have the enzymes to absorb them or the capability to absorb them in large quantities. And so basically they just stay in the intestine and the bacteria get a hold of them and they ferment them. Now, in some research, they all do, some of these things are beneficial, but a lot of times in my experience, people will find they get bloating, they get gas, they get different symptoms from them, rashes, whatever the deal is, especially if you have anything going on in the gut. So yeah, if you have the FODMAPs, no matter what your glucose to fructose ratio is, you're going to have digestive response to them if you're susceptible to it. Some people's microbiomes will handle certain FODMAPs. So as an example, I can handle broccoli and like cauliflower and vegetables like that, but I can't tolerate onions or garlic or anything in that family. And I don't do well with watermelon, but I do well with persimmon. So it's like, it's not that all FODMAPs are bad. It just, you may have an individual tolerance to different FODMAPs. And then as your gut profile adjusts, so over time, as my gut adjusted from like a carnivore-esque diet to like where I am now, I can tolerate a wider variety of foods, like overall, hands down. Oh. So like a lot of FODMAPs that were foods that would have been problematic in the past are now not an issue at all. Like I can eat them every single day. And the other thing I'll add to that picture before we get back on the track off the tangent is that with the microbiome, since it is an ecosystem, if you start adding other fibers that you tolerate, the bacteria that are present, or at least this is my thought processes or my theories around it, is the bacteria that are present will start to metabolize some of these different fibers. And then what happens is they'll produce different metabolites, which will encourage the growth of other bacteria, which will then create like a whole cross-feeding system. You can imagine it's like all this cross-feeding going on between these different species.
Uh-huh.
And then as you have, you can start expanding because you have more of these other species to break down some of these different fibers. So a lot of times when I have clients who are like have serious problems coming off carnivore, I will slowly start to increase their fiber sources, kind of like you would with a baby who's just coming off breast milk. And they get some of these different foods and it's like, oh, well, the bananas didn't work, but they do fine with the yams. And you kind of just go from that perspective. Then you may find that over time, as you add more things, you'll start to tolerate other things. And so that was what happened in my case. That's what I tend to see happen with a bunch of clients. As long as they don't have like a specific pathogenic overgrowth,
mm-hmm.
it's just like a dysbiosis. And so you start to see that increase and then FODMAP tolerance can increase.
That's so interesting because there's so many variables and everybody's gut is so different. And, yeah. But I like that. I say that a lot to clients. I say, you know, when they have really disturbed gut, I say, let's treat you like a baby. You know, you would not just all of a sudden give a baby a really complex plate of food, you know, and you would try to stick with a lot of liquid still and a lot of things that are dense in nutrients, but that are easy to digest. And, you know, so I'm glad you said that because that makes so much sense. Cause it's almost like the gut is just, it needs, gentle nourishment and it needs all those very difficult things that are causing problems to be taken away and then simplify everything again.
Yeah. And it's a step-by-step process of rebuilding instead of just like, bam, like here's your plant-based diet. You're going to eat like 15 types of grains and all these legumes and whatever. And then you feel terrible. It's like,
yeah.
I'm not saying that that's where you want to get to, but it's also like, that's not a good starting point. Cause not that people directly say this, but I think that the message that people absorb from some of the plant-based spheres, like you want to have all these fibers and all these fermentable fibers, all these different types from all these different vegetables and diversity and variety. And then people are like trying to get their guts better and they're adding all these things and they just like throwing them in there and they're not processing this or that. And there's no systematic process to it. They're not listening to what's working for them. And so then you just get into this place where you have all of these things on board. You don't know which ones you're tolerating, which ones you're not. Some days you're better, some days you're off, and you're kind of like, you're just wading around in the water and you don't know which direction to go. So it's better to like a systematic stepwise process in mm-hmm. an experimental approach of saying like, okay, I'm going to test this for 3 days and I'm going to test this and I'm going to test this and then slowly expanding and building out and keeping what works and throw out what doesn't.
Yeah. Interesting. So, going back to the pineapple juice quickly. So, one thing that I noticed was when I did drink it, it immediately created the cough, like it irritated, it set off the cough like right away. And so that could be the bromelain as well.
If the pineapple juice is pasteurized, it's unlikely to be the bromelain because the pasteurization process by definition inhibits enzymatic function. And the bromelain is an enzyme, it is a protein. So the heat treating of that will denature the protein structure and it won't work anymore. However, it could possibly be like a serotonergic response to, because the pineapple, of all the fruits, pineapple and I think plantains, bananas, tend to have a higher serotonin content. So it's possible that it could, your response could have been from that with the pineapple. Yeah. So you won't get past the FODMAPs as I mentioned, but if you just have a problem of too much fructose and not enough glucose, what you can do is you can add a glucose source. So if you had white rice or a potato in the meal that you had the watermelon, you are adding just pure glucose sources. So you may be able to overcome the problem of not having a one-to-one ratio of glucose to fructose if you add the potato or white rice, because you're just adding pure glucose. So now you're changing that ratio in favor of glucose. I've had clients who had issues with honey. Honey is actually one of the sneaky ones that gets a lot of people that are having gut issues. And then I had them add a little bit of dextrose with their honey to balance it out one-to-one. And they found that they actually tolerated it better. So there's things along those lines that can help. There's other problems with different honeys, but if it's a fructose problem, the having some extra glucose can help solve that.
Oh, cool. So watermelon and rice. Yum.
Yeah.
Hey, if it allows me to eat, but the FODMAP is ringing true. And I'm thinking like, it's really, really common. I actually was asked by a media company when I was writing my gut health books to write one on FODMAP. And I was like, I'm just done. You know, I didn't want to. And now I regret it because I feel like I would have learned so much more. But also, before we change our subject entirely, in terms of like, you know, I've been working on my gut for years. I mean, that's how I even acquired my, you know, Healthy Gut Girl brand. But I'm probably officially in menopause now. And I'm wondering, like, you know, the microbiome has altered now because of that. And so
there's a couple of things that you have going on in the situation. I don't know if you like, you want me to mention the like exercise piece or anything with the program.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So with the, something you have to be careful with when you start incorporating exercise. So I've had a couple of clients who've done Kitty's program. No bad things about it. I'm not saying anything bad. Mm-hmm. They just, when you start incorporating the exercise and then you also run a bit of a deficit or you're at maintenance calories or something along those lines, you can start to run into issues because essentially, and you have to be careful with the deficits. Like it's going to be important to adjust calories appropriately if you really want to like have a consistent weight loss and like see the progress and taper up and down. You can keep track of all of that. And I do that with people.
Yeah.
But the problem is that if you go a little bit too low or the exercise is increased to a certain level and you're like running a hard line deficit to some extent, you can start to see decrements in function in other areas of your body. So even for me personally, I recently ran a deficit by accident because when I came here, I didn't have all the food sources and I was still figuring it out and finding all the different things. And so I like didn't eat enough because I was initially eating like 3,600, 4,000 calories a day because I was working out 6-7 times a week.
Wow.
So when I got here, I like went down to like 27, 26. And I started to notice that I would have, that was because of my activity level.
Okay.
So that was like, I know in the bioenergetic sphere, and this is a tangent, so I'll come back to the, to talking about like the problems you run into in a caloric deficit.
Okay.
But what I do is in the bioenergetic sphere, there's a problem with people like calories. Oh, we like calories aren't important, this and that. And it's calories in, calories out from the perspective of like, you're just going to exercise and you're just going to eat less and it's just going to solve all your problems. There's more steps in between. So it's not a perfect picture, although understanding how many calories you're taking in and getting an estimate of what your caloric needs actually are is extremely helpful. Because you are essentially estimating your energy needs. So you want to be estimating energy needs. You want to be getting a sense of where you should be on average and then adjusting for what your actual activity level is for exercise, or if you have a physical job or you're very sedentary or thing or anything along those lines. Because if you do overeat, you will gain weight. That is a very normal process. It doesn't mean you're going to be obese, but you will gain body fat. The obesity is, I think, a different scenario with like metabolic dysfunction, a different story probably for another time. But essentially you can gauge where you're at, and then you can look at your intake. For me, I'll plot it in chronometer. I'll look at what my activity levels are. I'll get an estimate of where I'm at, and then I'll just look at what my weight is on a daily basis, and I'll take a weekly average. And when I take that weekly average, then I can see, okay, I'm here. And so like in the 3 months, I wasn't doing any of that. I was just like eating what I could eat. And like, we were moving around a lot. We were seeing different places. We were traveling. So in that 3 months, when I sat down and estimated my caloric intake, I was around 2,700 calories, but I went from like 210, 215 pounds down to 190 just because I had run a deficit for so long. And so then I had to sit down. I had to refigure out or estimate what my intake was currently, and then I had to run that and see like, is this reality? Because that's the biggest thing, is you can have an estimate, is like you can estimate your protein requirements. You can estimate all these different things. You have to go test it in real life, no matter what it is. You have the best supplement ever. You have to go test it in real life, because if it gives you full body rashes, like, you can't take it every day.
Right.
So with all those things, you test and go from there. So that's with the caloric piece. I think the binder, it's super helpful. But the problem is, if you run a heavy deficit, what happens is your body will start to take from other functions. So for me, if my deficit is too heavy, my desire to work out is gone. Like, I don't want to work out. When I go work out, I'm struggling to get through the workout mentally. My sleep starts to take a hit. My digestion is a little bit off, and then my work productivity falls off heavily. And then one thing that I actually is like, there's little sneaky barometers that I have to know if I'm in it having a deficit, or if something's bothering me or whatnot, is my desire for music, or like my enjoyment of music decreases. So anytime I start to notice that I'm like, oh, this song is terrible, all that song is terrible, then I'm like, oh, there's something going on, because usually I really love music, and I'll listen to music while I'm going through research. I'll listen to music when I'm working out. So like, you can find these little sneaky, I guess, indicators of if you're running things appropriately or not. And then you can also track to some extent. Now, everybody doesn't have to be that insane about it, but
yeah,
those are easy ways to, or tips and tricks. You can get a sense of where you should be and how to adjust accordingly, and things to look out for if you go too low. And then if you're going too high, you'll probably start to like be gaining weight, and you'll be able to see that. And if your diet is situated, you can make easy tweaks to correct that.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're running on a caloric deficit and you're expending too much energy, then the side effects of that, or the things that show up, is it metabolic stuff? Is it like you were going to reference potentially me getting sick because of it?
Yeah. So the way you can kind of think about it is, if the body's like a corporation, right? So you have HR, you have marketing, you have the board, which would be like the central nervous system. You have the housekeeping, all this type of stuff. The corporation only gets so much money. So if the corporation or the body doesn't have enough money, energy, then different departments will start to suffer. They won't have the resources. So maybe you have less housekeepers. Maybe marketing kind of takes a hit. Maybe the accounting team gets cut a bit, and now they're under pressure. The board never gets cut, right? Like, the central nervous system doesn't get cut. But those, you start to see like different areas will start to suffer because they don't have the resources. And so you can actually start to dig into those areas, and you find that you may get sick more easily. You may find if your deficit is too heavy, or you're training too much for your current deficit, you could find all those different things. You'll have problems with sleep. Your weight loss will kind of stall to some extent, or your composition won't be appropriate. Your desire to work out will be impaired. You'll stop moving around as much throughout the day. Your productivity won't be as good. And there is models to discuss this. They're a little bit more in depth, but there's an idea of like a constrained energy model. And what that means is that as you exercise, it doesn't just like, it just doesn't linearly increase your caloric expenditure. What happens is like, there's a certain point where you just cannot, your body can't make more calories to meet that exercise demand. So it starts to eat away from other functions. So that's on the over-exercising side. And then, so you have to keep that in mind, that if you're decreasing your caloric intake and then you're increasing your exercise, you're increasing your energy, but there's only so much that you can increase that, and you'll start to take a hit in other functions. And if you're also running a deficit, you can cause issues there. As an example, for a lot of women, I have had clients who were exercising and on a bit of a deficit, and they lost their cycle. And then for a lot of women, it's like, oh, that's, you know, like, now we have this huge thing. And basically it's like, just increase your calories back to this point.
Amazing.
And then on other times they've like had the fat too low because they wanted carbs high. And then they also lost their cycle. And that wasn't because there was a heavy caloric deficit, but they didn't have enough fat for their to allow their hormonal system to function appropriately. Now, this isn't like research. This is just working with people one-to-one and like experience. And basically I tweak fat up and adjust carbs a little bit. And then the cycle comes back like the next month. And it's because these different things, that's the marketing department saying, all right, you guys are all laid off. So the body just stops with the cycle.
I love that analogy. It's really good. The thing with Kitty Bloomfield's program that I'm on, the 16-week accelerator one, is that they really do. There's three trackers. There's three different trackers with your training. And then of course the food and then all your measurements and everything. And so they're very specific about it and they show, you know, how many calories per day I should be getting right now and how that'll increase over time. And I have not made it up to that caloric demand yet. I have not made it. I have been operating in a deficit for like 36 days. And it's, and so this program, and I didn't intend on speaking about this. We were going to do an episode with Kitty and Nyssa, and it's incredible that I did this because it's so revealing and confronting, like what exactly is going on with my life and my body and my habits, you know, the habitual things that I'm doing and not doing. And it's shocking to say that one of the most apparent things is that I just don't feed myself well. And that could have been, you know, at the core of a lot of the metabolic issues I was, or probably was dealing with for so long. And so, and that's, it's hard to eat that much when you don't eat that much. And I'm not even at 50, I'm at 1586, like 1,586 calories. That's, and I'm 5'8". And I, you know, that's not, I should be eating more than that. I'm 5'8" and I, you know, I'm like 138 pounds.
You're exercising,
Yeah. And so, so I have to get on it. She actually gave me a real good talking to last night. She was just like, you know, if you don't track, how are you going to know? Why are you even doing this? You know? So, and the things I thought would be the hardest were actually turned into the most fun, which was the actual working out, which I've learned to really enjoy and look forward to. But yeah, you do those hack squats and you don't have enough calories and you don't want to ever do them again. You don't recover well. You know, that was another thing I blamed it on. I thought maybe, you know, all this movement and I'm doing like, you know, 8,000, 10,000 steps a day or trying to. Yeah. And, you know, all that movement. And I thought, well, there's lymph drainage now. There's all this movement and detoxification happening. And maybe there's some stagnation here and it's like reflexing into my lungs or something. Like my brain was hitting on every possible thing. And it was a little bit of all of it. But yeah, there's that, the bottom line. I was, my corporation was laying off some respiratory people.
See, yeah, you're furloughing all your respiratory therapists.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's good. That was great insight. I'm glad we talked about that. Let's jump into the big meat and potatoes here, which is, is I've never had a men's health episode. We've talked about men's health here and there, but I'd like to, and this is general, so you just chop it up as you'd like, but when I think of women and hormones, you automatically jump to perimenopause and menopause. But we know that perimenopause and menopause are going to be greatly affected by how your hormonal life was all the way back to even probably your being born, you know, and you, what you acquired from your mother in terms of hormonal levels and estrogenic, you know, and estrogen dominance. And so is it the same with men?
It depends on the man's health. Like, I've had men that I've worked with who are in their 70s who have testosterones in like the 800 and 900s. And I've also had 20-year-olds that I've worked with who've had testosterones absolutely below the reference range. So like 100 something nanograms per deciliter is the scale. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things that goes into the male hormonal profile. And men technically don't have the, like, there's, they floated the idea of andropause inside some of the research. But as an example, my dad is 65 and he has a 1-year-old and he has a 5-year-old.
Whoa.
Yeah. So you can still, and he's not like the picture of health or anything. He's like 30 or 40 years of coffee and cigarettes. the American dream, right?
Wow.
So yeah, it's and his testosterone levels have been tested and they're like, okay, they're kind of mid range. So for men, there is the capability of actually going throughout the whole life and not having a heavy slowdown to a large extent of the hormonal profile. But as men get older, it's harder and harder to maintain an anabolic hormonal profile. It's harder and harder to maintain adequate levels of androgens and have them available to the tissues and have the tissues use them appropriately. And it's even harder in this current context And there's like a whole bunch of research coming out about this, with like the drop in sperm counts and the drop in testosterone levels, and that there's people are talking about the endocrine disruptors, the plastics, things along those lines. There's also in the PEAT community or the bioenergetic community, they talk about the high amount of polyunsaturated fatty acid consumption. I think there's multiple factors going into it. But for men, I think there's, you can have a high testosterone level or an adequate testosterone level over the course of your whole life, but it's dependent upon your lifestyle factors, how you're taking care of yourself. Or you can have problems when you're like a lot younger. If you're not taking care of yourself, you have different issues going on, and that can lead to the lower testosterone level. So there's, it's not the same as women where there's this, you have your cycle every single month and then you have children and whatnot. And then you come to the menopausal period and then the ovaries kind of shut down to a large extent. They stop fully functioning. With men, things can work across the whole lifespan, but there's things that like lifestyle factors and health are going to adjust whether that works or it doesn't work. And I've also had these same 20-year-old guys who are like 100 go up to 600, 700 on their testosterone by changing their lifestyle factors. And by lifestyle, for everybody in the audience, it's their, how they're sleeping, how they're eating. Are they, do they have any nutrient deficiencies? Is there problems inside the gut? Are they having a large amount of external stress? Is their exercise load too heavy? Are they not eating enough calories? Are they not eating enough fat? A lot of these different things, it's like, that's, it's a systematic approach of weeding all of these out and saying, all right, well, it's not going to be any of these things because we covered them. And then you kind of narrow down what the problem is. Because when you just get a lab test and it says, oh, your testosterone is X, it doesn't tell you why it's X. Mm-hmm. Doesn't tell you, you have to go and then figure out what why X is what it is. So it's, it, there's a lot of different factors that can be causing that. And so mm-hmm. You have to work through all of them.
Yeah. So, of course, when we think of men's health, that one of the big things we think about is, of course, testosterone. But, and we think like, the collective has this idea that testosterone can be dangerous, that testosterone can be unhealthy, that testosterone can cause prostate cancer, that testosterone can do all these different things. And just to touch on one of those things you said a minute ago, which is, you can have really high levels, and this is, this goes for women as well. I have clients also who have really high estrogen, and really in ratio balanced progesterone, and they don't have estrogenic symptoms. They have very healthy life, you know, hormonal lives. And then I have women who have unremarkable levels, like almost non-existent levels of estrogen and testosterone, and progesterone, and also thriving because it's in ratio, it's in balance. And then we have people who have almost no estrogen and zero progesterone and are riddled with hormonal issues. And then the opposite is true, where they have extremely high estrogen and no progesterone and riddled with hormonal issues. So we know just from science, but also anecdotally with our own clients, that it's not about how many hormone or how much the levels of your hormones so much as it is the balance of the hormones. What is testosterone balanced with? What is there a ratio that you want testosterone balanced with or against?
So there's a couple things with testosterone. You have testosterone can convert in two directions. It can convert to either estrogen or it can convert to dihydrotestosterone. What controls conversion to estrogen is the expression of an enzyme called aromatase. And that's heavily expressed by fat tissue. And there's other tissues that express it, but the fat tissue specifically expresses it. For dihydrotestosterone, it's usually abbreviated DHT. The enzyme there is 5-alpha reductase. So the testosterone can convert through 5-alpha reductase into dihydrotestosterone. There's other metabolites after that. It's like a way more in-depth discussion to get into all the specific metabolites after that. But essentially, depending on the state of the body, you may find that you aromatize more, you convert more into estrogen, or you convert more into DHT. And then also testosterone has its own effector functions as well. So you want to make sure you want testosterone to also be in a good spot. Now, there's the ratio between testosterone and estrogen. There's a ratio of testosterone to DHT. The other thing you can look at is how much free testosterone you have. So a lot of the hormones are bound to proteins in the blood. Albumin, another big one, is sex hormone binding globulin. And so a lot of times, now I know in the bioenergetic sphere, there's been questions around does it matter if the hormones are bound or testosterone is bound to this carrier protein, sex hormone binding globulin. In my experience, I tend to find that if somebody has really high sex hormone binding globulin and their testosterone is also high, they can get symptoms of low testosterone. That's because that protein binds the testosterone and you don't have a lot of free testosterone that can go and reach the different cells. So looking at a free testosterone level is also important. So you have estrogen, you have free testosterone, and then you have dihydrotestosterone. So those are all there's two conversion pathways and an amount that tells you how much of the free hormone you have. All of these are adjusted by the state of the body, which is always extremely to keep a context of when you're looking at this stuff. Another piece I'll add to the picture, just kind of on the side, is that when you're looking at testosterone, you are also looking at testosterone in ratio to cortisol. So cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It's a stress hormone, whereas testosterone is an anabolic hormone. So you have the testosterone to cortisol ratio. You have the testosterone to estrogen ratio. You have the amount of free testosterone you have, and then you have the amount of dihydrotestosterone you have. So the ideal profile that you would be shooting for as a man would be upper level testosterone. So above in the top, maybe 50% or the top quartile of the range. You'd want to see your free testosterone over the midpoint of the range towards the upper end of the range as well, perhaps top quartile as well. Dihydrotestosterone, you'd also want to see over the mid range in the, again, the top quartile is like ideal. And then the estrogen, you don't actually want estrogen smashed all the way down, because there is an idea inside the sphere or even in like bodybuilding spheres that you want super low estrogen. Super low estrogen is not good either. There is a role for estrogen and there is purpose for it. Too low is problematic. So then you want the estrogen. Depends on your testosterone level. If you go really high, you'll find that your estrogen will creep up with it, but there's a ratio. And then as far as cortisol, you want to make sure that your cortisol is probably mid-range or so. You don't want it in the upper end. And you definitely don't want the ratio between testosterone and cortisol to be really skewed in favor of cortisol. There's another component I'll add, but I want to leave it here for a sec, because there's another androgen to discuss in conjunction with this system that gives you an idea of the anabolic to catabolic state. And so essentially, I guess the overall picture that you're getting at here, that I'm getting at, is that there's multiple factors to look at with this hormonal profile. And it's not just testosterone. It's looking at where is it converting and then how much is it in ratio to other things. And then there's multiple other layers onto the system to understand, like, why is it not doing this or why is this happening? And then putting that in context of the overall person's health and lifestyle factors. So like when I'm looking at labs and I'm trying to ascertain where somebody is from a androgenic, estrogenic, catabolic, anabolic type of state, like I'm looking at multiple factors and I'm putting that always in the context of the person I'm looking at. You know, is this a lean 30-year-old guy who has a lot of muscle and takes care of himself? Or is this like an overweight guy who's 40, who doesn't really take that great care of himself? And then those things are going to give me an indication of why we're seeing what we're seeing in the lab work and like where all these other factors are coming from. And then I will take it, the ideas, and take it back to lifestyle things and make those adjustments to see it change in the lab work. I don't know if that was too much, but
no, it's good. I mean, it's certainly something that you want to take notes on and go back over it and look at it. You know, like I'll go through this again, because I'm looking at Dutch tests all the time. And I know those are urine metabolites, but I'd never thought to look at that testosterone cortisol ratio. But it's the same thing, right? Because that's, you're going to express the aromatase enzyme if your cortisol is dysregulated. You're going to have, even if you're low cortisol and you're at this adrenal fatigue level of exhaustion or whatever, that's still going to create an issue with conversion, right? Well, you were going to talk about another. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was going to talk about DHEA and cortisol ratios, which are also really important, which I kind of hits at what you're talking about with the Dutch test. But with a DHEA to cortisol ratio, DHEA is another hormone and it is produced by the adrenal gland like cortisol. And it actually is like directly antagonistic to cortisol. So when your body releases cortisol, it also releases DHEA. And cortisol goes and does its effector functions, and it has a negative feedback loop. So like after it's supposed to get the job done for whatever this stimulus is. So you're stressed out, you don't have enough food, you're fasting, whatever it is, you release cortisol. It gives releases sugar, releases fats so that you can use them when you don't have enough food. Or if you're under stress, it releases them as well, so that you're ready for that. Or if you have a big inflammatory response, you can release all this cortisol to taper down the immune system. So it releases that. It has this negative feedback loop with the brain, and the brain says, all right, we're good to go. We'll lower your cortisol. You're all set. But then it also releases DHEA, and the DHEA is there to kind of like minimize the damage that cortisol does to the tissues, to the cells overall. So they get released at the same time. The problem is the area of the adrenal glands that produce DHEA actually degrades as you get older and you're under significant amounts of stress.
Really?
But the area that produces cortisol does not. So as you get older, it's kind of the same thing that you see with menopausal women, is that you will have a high cortisol level, or you'll have unopposed cortisol. So your cortisol is higher, but you don't have the DHEA to compensate. And with the, you also have the testosterone component. So like if that's happening, usually there's like stress over the life or pathology or things like that, or just like
obesity,
very old age.
Is a big one, right?
Is yeah, when go ahead.
It's when the metabolized cortisol is much higher and the DHEA is very low. That's a lot of things, but obesity is one of them, isn't it? And and just like ongoing, like PTSD, people that have a lot of trauma, stuff like that, you can see it quite a bit.
Yeah, so you can see it in like sustained stress from PTSD or psychological issues. You can see it elevated over time from like super low calorie diets, over like even the people who are on caloric restricted diets for longevity tend to have like elevated cortisol levels and a bit lower DHEA levels, which aren't ideal. You can see it in metabolic dysfunction, diabetes, obesity. That's driven through not just like this external stress, but like from internal metabolic stress going on, and yeah, those hormones trying to adjust and adapt to what's going on. So okay, like a lot of things can lead to this. It could be from you drive 2 hours a day, every single day to commute to work. And then you go to work and you don't like your work and your boss gets on your case every single day. And all of those are stressors. So a lot of times just like chronic psychological life stressors can drive an elevated cortisol response, an elevated fight or flight or catecholaminergic response. So like adrenaline, noradrenaline. So all of those things can drive those processes. But essentially over time, you have this unopposed cortisol, lower DHEA, and then you have the lower testosterone and elevated cortisol. And so again, the DHEA directly opposes the cortisol at multiple levels, and it's kind of protecting your body. When you're young, you can put up with it because you have all this DHEA. But as you go under chronic stress, you start to like go through these phases, you can see it drop. See cortisol high. So that's another androgen that you're looking at there. And then you can also see as men get older, they have metabolic dysfunction, their testosterone levels can be a bit lower, and then cortisol will also be a bit higher. And it's not that you want to go and pharmacologically just like jack up testosterone and lower cortisol. You want to kind of fix all the other pieces around that. You can do that, but you also want to fix all the pieces around that to make sure that the underlying state and foundation is appropriate, so that you're not just artificially managing the system, but the context is not correct. Because then you can start to see like things, you could start to heavily aromatize into estrogen with your testosterone therapy. And then you can start to feel flat with the cortisol kind of out of whack because you're artificially tanking it with supplements and herbs and all these different types of things. So there's a way to go about that. The other thing I want to briefly mention with DHEA, and the reason I brought it up, is in menopause, for women specifically, most estrogen at that point is coming from conversion from DHEA from the adrenal gland. So your adrenal gland is still producing some DHEA, and then that DHEA gets converted to estradiol. As men get older, the DHEA is also a source for testosterone. So it can be DHEA can be converted into estrogen and testosterone. So those are things to keep in mind as you get older. And if like that's the adrenal gland and also the testicles.
Just question.
Go ahead.
So DHEA does not make all androgens from the DHEA? Like
it can convert downstream into all of them. But the problem is like, it's like the whole pregnenolone steal idea as well, where if you take pregnenolone, it converts into cortisol. The hormones can all convert downstream into a variety of different metabolites. So cortisol can go to progesterone or allopregnenolone, could go to aldosterone, could go to all these different hormones.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that the hormones themselves have effects. So DHEA has an effect. Pregnenolone has an effect. And those effects happen to be, like, DHEA happens to be anti-cortisol.
Okay.
And so if you're seeing like, oh, it's going to convert down into just straight estrogen, it's like, yeah, probably at high doses, it'll convert to estrogen. And in studies in women, you do see that. And in men, but it also converts to a whole bunch of other things. And it also mm-hmm. has its own effects in its own right. So you have to, if you're trying to understand conversion, you need to understand what's the effect of that hormone and then what's the state of the person. As you alluded to earlier, if you have a high cortisol level, that can drive aromatase expression or production of that enzyme that creates estrogen. So if you're under a lot of stress and you go high dose DHEA, you may find that you have a high estradiol level for men or for women. Or you could find that if you're not under that much stress, you just get like you get a higher DHEA level, maybe a small bump in estradiol and maybe some androgens or something along those lines.
Okay.
So that's,
got it. Yeah. I never liked the pregnenolone steal concept because I feel like pregnenolone being the mother of all hormones is donating to make where it's in demand. Like, it's not like being stolen. It's just its purpose is to donate where it's needed, is what I always thought. So pregnenolone steal just seemed to me like it's doing it on accident, or it's happening in it. You know what I'm saying? Is it an accurate?
That is accurate that the body will use the resource. But something to note about pregnenolone is that pregnenolone directly lowers the stress response at the brain level. So that when you take pregnenolone, it interacts with the GABAergic system in the brain, and then that system helps to lower stress response from the brain level directly. So you can, if you say you have somebody who's under a heavy amount of stress, and like while you're fixing your diet, you're managing all their lifestyle factors or sleep, all this type of stuff, you can supplement DHEA, pregnenolone. If it's a guy and he's already on TRT, you can use some of the TRT things. I don't have the ability to write people's scripts, so I don't write them scripts for that. But you have these, you can use these things in the meantime. You can use herbs like rhodiola or ashwagandha. So you can bring the cortisol down, bring the DHEA up, lower the stress response at the brain, and then fix all the lifestyle components as well. And so you're kind of managing the problem symptomatically to some extent in the meantime, or like rehabilitating the problem while you're fixing the underlying foundation. And I think this is probably an important point to bring up, is that if the foundation is not right, no matter how much pharmacologic management or hormonal management you put on board, unless it's like synthetic hormones, like what the bodybuilders use, you're going to have a hard time. It's mm-hmm. not, things are going to go a little awry or not be appropriate because all the other pieces aren't in order. And that's,
I think that's really profound and important, because I think it's the same thing with even taking progesterone, because you can have all of these different types of things going on, and progesterone can help, but it can also not help. It can also be a problem if you are taking progesterone and you've not done anything to correct your diet, or you've not done anything to correct your mineral dysregulation, and you've got like really low RBC magnesium, and you're trying to take progesterone to fix all your hormonal problems, and you're underdosing for your needs, you can make a mess. So I think that was an important thing to be said, for sure, is like, there's so many other pieces that need to be looked at when you're talking about fixing anything, really. Right.
Yeah. So that say someone in your audience, say their husband is suffering or dealing with low testosterone, or his hormonal function just isn't what it used to be. The first things to address is the foundational lifestyle components. It doesn't mean that you can't go to those deeper level or more in-depth supplemental strategies. If anything, fixing those components will make those supplemental strategies work better in the long run. Mm-hmm. So but you want to get those things down right. Because the other thing is, and I see this all the time. I have guys, even young guys, they're in their 20s, and they come, they're like, I had low testosterone, they put me on TRT, and now I can't get off. And they shouldn't have been on TRT in the first place, because they're in their 20s. They don't need TRT. they need to fix all these other things in their life. You know, they're over 6 foot and they're eating 2,100 calories a day and they don't go to sleep at a good time. It's like, you're not going to have high testosterone doing these things. This is not you. In order to produce these types of hormones, in order to have this hormonal profile, the body needs to have the state to produce it. So if you're not in the state to produce it, then just augmenting it artificially, sure, it gets you into that state, but it's not solving anything else. So then a lot of times they get weird symptoms. They get heavy aromatization. They can get acne. They can get worsening of their symptoms. They don't feel better. Maybe they feel better for a little while and then it's not the same anymore. Their libido still isn't good. So, and I've seen this time and time again, this is even for young guys. So, and a lot of times it's just that those things aren't right. And if that's not right, the hormone replacement, just having things look good on paper, doesn't solve the actual problems.
Mm-hmm.
So the foundation,
or it fixes some things, like you said, and then they start losing their hair, or they start getting super moody and angry, and that's estrogen, right?
Yeah, that could be estrogen. There's a lot of different things that could actually happen with the hormonal replacement therapy. And
like, yeah, let's jump on there, unless there's something that I skipped from. But nope. That's a big deal. And I have personal experience with it as well with clients and whatnot, where, you know, men have like pretty severe depression and or they're getting to a point, they're just losing their drive for life. They're losing, you know, call it midlife crisis, or even, you know, even not, even just like really depressed, hard to get to work, no desire to work out, stuff like that. And then they do get on testosterone so a lot of people think of testosterone, they think of like, they go right away to Arnold Schwarzenegger and like big, huge bodybuilding people, anabolic steroid type. But we're talking about like lifestyle levels of just increasing testosterone to like, I don't know, 0.5, I think is a common once a week, or 1 mil shots is a really common dose that I've seen, or prescription. And, and then they give them an estrogen blocker, like anastrozole, right? Let's talk about, so yes, we know if we have some listeners whose husbands are feeling that way, they're having issues, low libido, all these different types of things, and they check their testosterone and it's low. And they say, okay, let's go ahead and get on some injections. Not a bad idea, but you're saying first address these lifestyle issues. If you're not making testosterone, what does your cholesterol look like? What does your lifestyle look like? What is your diet, et cetera? Exercising for men, and testosterone is a bigger deal than for women. Like apparently exercising for men, that really impacts testosterone levels more so than women, says Georgie Dinkoff. But then they get on the testosterone and now they're doing great. And they're like, I don't want to take this anastrozole, or they're taking it and they have apprehensions about that. What's up with that?
Okay. So there's a lot of questions in there. So as to the testosterone therapy, there's a couple of things there. A lot of times I think, if you're just getting like a generic testosterone therapy from a, you know, a generic testosterone clinic or something like that, in my experience, I tend to see the dosages are likely too high. So that's problem number one. And the reason why is there's a couple things. So when the dosage is too high, it completely shuts down your entire system. So that's the LH and FSH that come from your brain that signal to your testicles, hey, make hormones, make sperm, all these types of things. It completely shuts that down. So if the dose is too high chronically, you can find it's really hard to get off once you get on, because the system gets shut down for an extended period of time. Another problem is when the dosage is too high, you're more likely to aromatize, because your levels get so high, the body starts converting more into estrogen. For a lot of guys that I've worked with that are on it, if their level gets too high, you start to see estrogen start to get up really high. And the thing is, you don't need to have that high dosages to keep your levels appropriate. The reason why I think some of the levels get so high is because if you're doing a once a week shot, you're getting, and the shots are, the testosterone is bound to an ester. So the ester inhibits its metabolism, so it can stick around a lot longer, so the body just doesn't burn right through it.
Oh, in your body.
Enanthanate. Yeah. No. So when they, when they make the testosterone,
okay,
they bond the testosterone to a compound. It could be called, the types of compound is enanthanate, undecanoate, all these different types of esters. And what happens is when the testosterone is bound to that ester, when they're stuck together, the body's enzymes can't come in and just start breaking the testosterone down as easily because that ester blocks it. So it keeps in your system for a longer time so that you can do a 1 week injection and have it last all week, or to, all of them have different half-lives. So the amount of time it takes to metabolize them, and some last longer than others. Okay. So you can get that once a week dose. The problem is you get this spike in testosterone and it slowly comes down. But that spike for a lot of guys, I think, increases that aromatization. And that's why they hop on the aromatase inhibitor. So there's that piece as well. The other thing is, since the ester is harder to metabolize and you have this higher testosterone value for longer, it adds to that problem of trying to come off into the future. Another problem is when you're taking testosterone, you're doing it once a week or once every 2 weeks or whatever the dosing scheme is that the provider has set up. What happens is you are not matching a normal circadian rhythm of testosterone where you have a higher amount in the morning and then it goes from there. So what winds up happening is you just have this higher amount and just stays there all the time, and it just slowly goes down as your body metabolizes through the ester. And that, I also think, causes some issues with the system. So with these things in mind, my preference with testosterone is more to do like a daily small dose dosing. And that, what that means is, like, the average man produces between 6 to 7 milligrams of testosterone per day. Up to 10 would be like the max. And so there's been quite a few guys who I worked with where I've worked with them and their provider to get them to like 10 milligram dosages with micro needles or with a topical solution once a day in the morning. So it matches their normal testosterone circadian rhythm. Hmm. It doesn't shoot their levels up super high, so they don't aromatize super heavily. And then it's easier to come off when they want to in the future, because they don't crash the whole system with these esters that hang around for a really long time. And in those cases, it's using like testosterone base, which is testosterone not bound to any type of ester. So that would be kind of the ideal way to go about the replacement, and less so this like high dose once a week or whatever the dosing schedule is with an estered form. There's another type of testosterone therapy that's also coming out. It's intranasal testosterone. And it's essentially, you just squirt up your nose. The nice thing about that is it doesn't completely crash the system for testosterone either. So your LH and your FSH don't stay down for super long. So if you're trying to come off your TRT, you can use a topical or an intranasal testosterone so that you don't, that will allow you to keep your levels at a good spot. And they last for a shorter period of time to allow your LH and FSH, those hormones that allow your testicles to work, to kind of come back up. And then if you're thinking about it, you can also use these to, so that you don't have to worry about that problem in the future. So those are things to think about for, you know, health replacement. If you want to be a bodybuilder, you're probably not going to want to go this direction, because it's not going to give you enough of the androgenic anabolic steroid to like grow to massive sizes. That requires different things. But for guys trying to get health, those are two options that I would prefer. Or even a third one is like using a smaller, like an insulin needle, and pinning smaller doses on a more frequent basis with a, maybe a base instead of an ester, something along those lines. So, and then now to the aromatase inhibitor. In those three therapies, you don't, a lot of guys find that they don't necessarily need to use an aromatase inhibitor. So that's something to keep in mind, because they're not having the massive spikes and the esters keeping things around a long time. So the aromatization doesn't increase drastically. The other thing is, you're doing things through the skin has a very high concentration of 5-alpha reductase. Particularly, a lot of guys who do the topical stuff will put it around the scrotal region, because the scrotal skin has very high amounts of 5-alpha reductase. So it actually pushes the testosterone more towards dihydrotestosterone than it does to estrogen. So those are, that's something else that you can do to help minimize the need for aromatization. As far as aromatase inhibitors go, anastrozole, exemestane, which I think is aromacin is the generic name for it, or the drug name for it. Aromacin. I think it's aromacin and arimidex. I think arimidex is anastrozole and aromacin is exemestane. So exemestane is a steroidal structure It has a steroidal structure, so it's like a steroid hormone, but it blocks the aromatase enzyme. I think it's a suicide inhibitor, meaning it bonds in and that enzyme is done. So your body has to actually make more aromatase for it to come back. You have to be careful with both of them, because if the dose is not appropriate, and the doses for a lot of people don't have to really be that high, if the dose is not appropriate and you use the wrong dose, you will feel worse than before you were on testosterone therapy, because if you crush estrogen too much, the symptoms are pretty terrible. Mm. Now, I've crushed my estrogen before with verified lab work. I was never on TRT, but like playing around with different anti-estrogenic things just to see what it felt like and what would happen. And I felt it was terrible. I had like depressive symptoms. My joints were super dry, cracking, and like very uncomfortable. I had insomnia during the night, but I was like hypersomnic during the day. So I was like very sleepy during the day. Circadian rhythm was all types of off. My motivation and mental function were terrible. So while you don't want low testosterone, you also don't want high testosterone and high estrogen, or high testosterone and super low estrogen. You want to kind of have a good testosterone level and an adequate estrogen level. And I think that's important. Now, there is some parts of the sphere that people find, they're saying, oh, you let your estrogen go to whatever level you want. That's also not a good idea. If it gets too high, there are problems with that. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, there's a nice range for these things that you're really looking to stay in, so that you don't start to develop problems on either side. And then there's a way to go about things so that you minimize risks and downsides in different areas. You don't have to use other substances. So as an example, if you're running or you're pinning high dose testosterone in an ester form, if your entire hormonal system shuts down and you want to have kids, a lot of times you have to go use something like HCG, which is human chorionic gonadotropin. And there's problems associated with that as well. So like, there's a way to go about it to get the levels appropriate, and then without and minimizing the downsides from a health perspective. If you're going to be Mr. Olympia, you have to do other things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so interesting, because so when would you say, if someone's going to do TRT, would you say, this is a general question, at what point should they include progesterone? Like, or should they?
So it's when I work with somebody who's working with the clinic to use TRT, I usually am working with the person plus their provider. What I will usually do is I'll have them, they'll be on their TRT already. I'll start fixing all their lifestyle pieces. So let me just dial that in really first, and we'll get to those other hormones, because they're in that same pathway. Mm-hmm. First things first is diet. You have the diet right. Level one. Level two, make sure micronutrients are covered. Level three, make sure lifestyle situated, sleep, all this type of stuff is good. Make sure the gut is functioning well. And we'll talk about that in a second, because if the gut, endotoxin from the gut can directly lower pretty much all hormonal function across the board. Thyroid, sex, steroids, everything. So that's a huge one that's really important. You know, in the light of this name of this podcast and your brand, I think we should talk about that.
Yes.
But so get the gut right, get the sleep right, get the daily structure right, make sure you're covering all your nutrients, make sure the diet is solid, manage stress appropriately, all those things, like go through that pathway. Most guys I've worked with go through that pathway, testosterone and androgenic function and libido and morning wood and drive and all that comes back, no problem. If they're still wanting to go into the hormonal direction and TRT direction, or they're already on TRT, this is the point where I start to consider the other hormonal pieces. So the first thing I would use would be pregnenolone. Pregnenolone has protective effects in the testicles against running the higher dose steroids, because they can create oxidative stress inside the testicles. There's some problems associated with that. You get atrophy of the testicles. You definitely don't want that long term. The pregnenolone can help to backfill some of the different neurosteroid pathways and other pathways that may get downregulated by shutting down the whole entire hormonal system because of the use of this exogenous hormone. So pregnenolone is helpful from there. Next piece is a little bit of DHEA can be helpful depending on the person. And then as far as progesterone, some guys, I would test it out, because you can use it from an anti-estrogenic perspective. But I would, with each of these, actually, I would test them out individually, give them a couple days, maybe a week, and see what your response is. so that you make sure you don't have a terrible response. And that would be the arbiter of whether or not you're going to use this thing or not. Some guys find progesterone is great. For me, I hate progesterone for my own usage. For people I work with, I use it all the time. But for me, it's sedative. And then there's with progesterone, it can convert heavily to allopregnanolone. Mm. And when it converts to allopregnanolone for me, it's like my mood is gone. Like I'm very agitated and easily irritated and all this type of stuff. And
really? Because allopregnanolone is meant to be sedative and anxiolytic, but it's that sounds like an estrogenic. Okay.
There's a U-shaped curve with some of the neurosteroids, where at certain levels they have X effect, and then at other levels they can start to create different symptom profiles or different psych profiles. Even DHEA can have some modulation at GABA, and for some people can create that agitation perspective. So, and again, this is not necessarily because of estrogen. It could be because of what's going on with neurosteroids. And I've seen this time and time again with different people. So I would test those out and see where you're at from there. Okay. For most people I work with, though, that's not the case. But for me, I'm very sensitive personally to different neurosteroid compounds. So like I tolerate pregnenolone great, but I don't tolerate progesterone that great. But and then DHEA is kind of middle of the road.
Okay.
So it's, and then as an example, like I've tried testosterone before just to see the feel, because I like to feel how the substances work. Because when I talk to people, I can tell them about the feel as well as the theory.
Mm-hmm.
And testosterone for me is relaxing. So you would think, like, if DHEA is agitative, if it was estrogen, then why would testosterone be relaxing? And then DHT for me also creates a bit more, it's like a assertiveness, but also a bit of an agitation. Whereas testosterone is super calming and like calm, cool, collected perspective. And so, again, I think that's more around what's going on with neurosteroids and a variety of different things, and not just like, oh, estrogen or not estrogen or something along those lines.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. And so if someone is already on TRT, then it's this process of transitioning, you were saying, and checking like the pregnenolone. So is that topical or is it oral, or does it matter?
Yeah. So pregnenolone, my preference is oral. I like it better oral. What I tend to use the pregnenolone, so Georgie's product, Panserone, that's a pretty good topical product. I use that more as needed for like injuries, or like when I broke my foot, I used Panserone and progesterone, even though it gets me a little agitated, and it was super helpful for healing. So those types of things are, from that perspective, topical. I use it more that way. DHEA can go kind of either way, depending on the person. I personally like it orally as well, but again, I like to keep the doses on DHEA lower, around like 5 milligrams, 10 milligrams max in a dose.
Mm-hmm.
Pregnenolone, all different types of ranges have worked. So I've had people do good with 5, 10. For me, I can tolerate 50 to 100 milligrams, no problem. And then for progesterone, it depends on your formulation. And it depends on what I like to do with men and women is titrate the dose upward. So start at a low dose, see the response, and then titrate upwards so that you make sure you don't have like a really negative response to it. And I tend to like to use it that topically, but you can also rub in the gums and things along those lines. And then the formulation I usually like has, I've actually used your formulations with clients before.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. And I've had some clients have some really good effects. So yeah, that's, nice. But I
know.
Use it for them. I use it topically, most times, mm-hmm. or in the gums, not so much orally.
Mm-hmm. So would the pregnenolone on the scrotal skin on the testicles be wise?
The pregnenolone
on TRT.
In that case, it's more those, if I was the pregnenolone or the DHEA, I'm not usually using in that fashion.
Okay.
That I usually have people just use or take orally. It's actually the oral dosing is, I think, a lot easier for people if they tolerate it, because mm-hmm. you can just take it with your morning your breakfast or your dinner, and just landmark it with your meals so that you always remember. Whereas if you have to put it on topically, then it's like uncomfortable in your clothes and they're kind of greasy.
Yeah.
So I usually go the oral route with them.
Okay.
The other test, one thing I do want to mention here really quickly is if you're on TRT and it's working for you and you have it dialed in, then I wouldn't just automatically go to the things that I said.
Okay.
It's if you're not, if it's not working for you or you're thinking about it, I would consider those options before like just hopping on an ester dosage.
The first question, why do men spend so long on the toilet? Cute. Okay.
Do you want the politically correct answer?
I'm scared to hear the answer, but I know it has something to do with avoiding chores. let's see. Okay. Does progesterone help with prostate issues, especially large prostate?
So I haven't looked directly at research for progesterone for prostate issues, but understanding what's going on with the prostate, if a man is very estrogenic or there something, anything along those lines, very estrogenic, higher cortisol levels, stuff going on with the gut, those can all cause issues with the prostate. I don't think that just androgens alone are causing the prostate issues. I think there's more to the picture. But I think it's possible or it's feasible that progesterone would be helpful for a man with prostate issues, or particularly enlarged prostate. There's other things that I would go to. And one thing I'm very hesitant about, and I can't tell people not to do it, but I would very much recommend if somebody's dealing with a prostate issue to really look into the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. So that's finasteride and dutasteride, and see if they're really worthwhile to use in the long term, because there are some problems with them overall. I'm not a huge fan of them personally. And the reason I say is a lot of times if you have prostate issues, it's kind of like first line therapies are the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. Because the theory is that DHT is causing prostate enlargement inside the local prostate environment. So they use these drugs to block conversion of testosterone to DHT by blocking the whole 5-alpha reductase enzyme. But there's problems with that because the 5-alpha reductase enzyme also produces neurosteroids. And then it also is one of the enzymes that metabolizes and degrades cortisol. So you can get a whole bunch of hormonal issues. If some guys specifically can get a ton of hormonal issues using 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, because it doesn't just block testosterone conversion into DHT. And then on the other side is DHT does have beneficial effects in the body. It's not just this poison that causes you to get a large prostate. Mm-hmm. It opposes estrogen. It's associated with tons of different functions and tissues in the brain, all these different in the gut, all these different areas. So just indiscriminately blocking it, I don't think is a good idea. And then you can have unopposed estrogen or the other things that I mentioned as well. So I would keep an eye on that specifically.
I think it was Georgie that had a podcast a few years ago talking about DHT being like the red herring and like, you know, it's that it's implying that it's definitely an estrogenic issue. I mean, of course, going back to the whole lifestyle, metabolic diet, inflammation, all the things, but ultimately like it's like estrogen gone rogue. And, you know, I just throw progesterone at everything and with women. So any kind of inflammation, any kind of, you know, mitogenic qualities that something has, I'm going to be like, progesterone. But with men, I know men are different. And so I don't ever really, I'm like, try it, but I don't, you know, do that on your own experimentation, but, it can't hurt, can it?
No, I think it's likely to help, but I think you'd have to test with an individual to see the response. On the flip side, I think there's more to cancer than just like this hormone or that hormone. And Jay and I are actually going to do a podcast very soon going through cancer directly and the mechanisms and all this type of stuff. So that's actually a topic that I was just researching it today. So
oh,
that's
great.
Fresh in my mind.
Awesome. Well, that was one of the questions, was testicular cancer, anything on that? So you want to save that? Or
that's
I know
that's,
it's broad.
It's just a big, that's such a broad one, right?
Is it, but that, I mean, I have to have you back. I know you're a busy man, but I've been making lists of things that we could do entire shows on. So what about, what hormones should men get tested?
What I would look at is cortisol, ideally an AM cortisol. Now I wouldn't put AM cortisol on the lab, because if you don't get it before, I think 9 AM, they won't let you get it. So, and I've had that problem where I came at like 9:15 and they wouldn't let me do it. I'm like, I paid for these tests. I ordered them. So I would get a cortisol test, but then just go make sure you do it in the morning. Then I would get DHEA, so you can see, and specifically DHEAS, so that you can look at the ratio between cortisol and DHEA. DHEAS is kind of like the total amount of DHEA you have stored up. And then the DHEA value itself is like the raise or adjustment based on acute situation. So I'd look at DHEAS and ratio to cortisol. So cortisol, DHEAS.
Okay.
The next one I would look at would be prolactin. Now, we didn't talk about this, but prolactin is a hormone coming from the pituitary gland. And what it does is it has a lot of things, but it shuts down your testicular function. That's one of the things that it does. So it basically lowers the whole gonadotropic axis. So that's LH and FSH. And that can cause low testosterone in and of itself. As a side note, I had a client who took a whole bunch of prescription opiates for a period of time from after a surgery. And then his testosterone value came back low and the doctor put him on TRT, and it's opiates raise prolactin and lower testosterone. So he didn't need to go on TRT. He just needed to stop taking opiates and his testosterone would come back. So that's just an interesting side note. If you are that, like, things like that can be simple. Those could be like very simple solutions if you look at the whole picture. Mm-hmm. So you want to look at prolactin. You want to look at LH and FSH. So those are the hormones coming from the brain, telling the testicles, hey, make testosterone, make sperm, all that type of stuff. Another thing you want to look at is testosterone, total testosterone. Then you want to look at a free testosterone. Then you want to look at a sex hormone binding globulin. So those are going to tell you, hey, this is how much testosterone your testicles are producing. Then the SHBG and the free testosterone are going to tell you, this is how much you have free to go and do things. And this is how much you have bound up, or this is, you have a lot of this binding hormone. And different, like, high, super high fiber, low fat diets can raise sex hormone binding globulin. And then metabolic dysfunction can lower sex hormone binding globulin. So like a lot of other things can affect each one of these variables. And so if you have somebody reading the labs, if they know how different things affect the different variables, you can see, oh, this is high and this is happening here. And then you look at their diet and like, oh, this is probably why. And then you make the adjustment, or this lifestyle factor, and you make the adjustment and you can tweak things like that. So that's why you want to see the different pieces. Then good.
The prolactin is interesting because, you know, we're talking about this a lot lately in the group, which is that it can indicate how much estrogen is in tissues. And mm-hmm. which of course is something that we're trying to figure out with menopausal women, because they want to take estrogen because their estrogen is so low, but we've got this high prolactin saying otherwise. And does it show this? Is that also indicative with men of tissue, of bound tissue, estrogen tissue?
I think it can be. I think there's a lot of different things that can cause the prolactin to raise. So like one thing is anything that's very opioidogenic can lower dopamine, and things that lower dopamine will cause a rise in prolactin. The other thing is stress itself drives prolactin. So kind of like what I was talking about with the, like, firing the marketing department because you don't have enough money. The way that the stress system manages reproduction so that it kind of like saves the energy from reproductive processes is when you're under a lot of stress, you raise prolactin and it shuts down the sex hormone axis. And that's like that's the mechanism by which it works. And that's also the same thing you see in women who are postpartum. So their prolactin levels are super high after they have the baby, and then the progesterone levels drop off because you don't have this placenta that's producing tons of progesterone. And that causes, I think, this huge hormonal imbalance that you see, postpartum depression and all these different things going on. And then that leads to the loss of the cycle, and the prolactin continues to go as the mother breastfeeds, because the stimulation of the nipple leads to increased prolactin secretion and prevents the mother from having another baby or getting pregnant, or should, hopefully, while she's breastfeeding. Yeah, hopefully. So those are, like, prolactin's job is to do that. So there could be a bunch of different things. It could be a marker of the estrogen content in tissue. I know that's something that I think Georgie had mentioned that specifically, or he had a post or an article or blog post or something about that. But I think that there's a couple different things that can affect prolactin. So that's why it's important to understand the full context so that you can narrow the different things down and see kind of what specific thing that it is, and then make the appropriate adjustment. Because if you go and pursue a theory and it's not necessarily the correct one, you can run into some problems.
Okay.
Yeah. So the other one I'd look at, DHT is not quite as important, but I would consider looking at DHT. So just as a recap, you have cortisol, DHEAS, prolactin, LH, FSH, total testosterone, free testosterone, and then DHT. Then the other thing you would want to look at is you're going to want to look at your estradiol as a man. You don't have to look at the other ones, but estradiol specifically to see how much you're converting over. Then you can look at your thyroid profile. And the reason why is thyroid is important for sex hormone production, because thyroid controls the movement, the LDL receptor, so the receptor that takes cholesterol into the cell. And then it also pushes that cholesterol into the mitochondria and forces it to be produced into pregnenolone, which is, as you said, the mother of all hormones. It gets converted into all the other hormones. So if your thyroid function is poor, you may find that your androgenic function or your hormonal function is not going to be ideal either. So that's another area. If thyroid's not looking well, then correct that, and you may find everything else improves on a sex steroid perspective. So now for thyroid, what you want to look at is your TSH. You want to look at your free and total T3 and T4. You want to look at your reverse T3, and you could look at autoimmune markers if that's a risk, but most times it's not. So those are the things I'd look at specifically for thyroid, and then a lipid panel, because a lipid panel will tell you what's going on with thyroid as well. Usually hypothyroidism leads to super elevated lipids. And I can usually tell if somebody's on a low carb diet, if they're by their lipid panels and things like that. So it can give you an indication, or you could just ask them, but the lipid panel is helpful as well.
Okay. So progesterone is not an issue for men, is not a thing, but what about xenoestrogens? Okay, so men don't have as much estrogen as women, obviously. But what about xenoestrogens? All these children, you know, with gynecomastia and all this adipose tissue, like huge, massive adipose bellies with and cortisol bellies at 12 and 15. And, and so if you're, even if it's estrogen mimickers in the body and not really estrogen, the body doesn't know. It's just doing its thing with these fake estrogens. And so you have these high levels of estrogen. Don't you want to oppose that with progesterone? I mean, don't we need to start looking at these people, at these men that have these female-like symptoms that are happening, not just young kids, but these men that are getting older and they start to get into their andropause that where they're getting weepy and moody and they're getting the belly and they're getting kind of menopausal attitudes and stuff. Like, why not? And Georgie takes progesterone all the time, like 3 milligrams or something of the Progesti or his stuff. And so why not progesterone these days? Now it's different, I'm sure, even 15 years ago, let alone,
To test it or to take it?
Both.
To test it, I don't think it would give you too much diagnostic value to test the progesterone for men, because the values are low. And then sometimes I've seen high progesterone levels in men who also had higher cortisol levels and things like that going on. And there's conversion pathways through there as well. And so it wasn't, and they were, I don't think it gives you a diagnostic to determine whether you would use it or not. So if the test isn't giving me an idea of something I can do for the person, I tend not to recommend that test. Because it just doesn't I think it's almost a waste of money for the person. That doesn't mean that progesterone is a waste of money. I'm not saying that. I want to be clear. It just that you may testing it or not testing it, I don't think it's going to make the difference or be the arbiter of whether you use progesterone or not.
Okay.
Now, for using progesterone for men, could they use it? Yes, I'm on board with all of that. I just use the hormones for me are usually not a first line therapy right off the bat. Because a lot of times people who are having these symptoms have a whole bunch of other things going on. And something else to consider specifically on the xenoestrogens, and the main ones to really focus in on, because I assume most of your audience is not plugging away at like flax seeds and soy and things like that. Is like
I used to recommend seed cycling up until a year and a half ago. So
okay, well then maybe those are going to be the higher phytoestrogen content specifically. Mm-hmm. But the main ones to really worry about are the plasticizers. So those are like the BPA, BPS, the phthalates, things along those lines.
And glyphosate.
Well, glyphosate would be a pesticide, so not necessarily a plasticizer. So that those are, and the mechanisms would be a little bit different from the glyphosate's effect inside the body than the BPA, BPS, phthalates, things along those lines. And so what I want to get to here specifically is that while they are synthetic, they have an estrogen mimicking property. They also impair thyroid function, oppose the androgen receptor, specifically BPA, and then it also upregulates the glucocorticoid system. And the way it does that is it blocks or impairs the negative feedback loops. So it's not just xenoestrogen. It's basically like the mother of all endocrine disruptors. And a lot of the plastics, like they're just starting to even uncover their effects. And for a while, they're like, oh, this small amount of this thing shouldn't be a problem. But even in like some of the endocrine textbooks, what they're starting to show is even really minute amounts of some of these things are quite disturbing. Nice. To the biologic systems, even in like animals or even in the ocean and things like that. So there's a lot of things going on. So progesterone could be helpful on a couple fronts there. And it could be something worthwhile for a man to use for sure. I would just go through again the foundation first and then get to the different hormonal pieces. So yeah. I'm on board with using it. I just usually, for me, I kind of work through a systematic approach somebody, and I step it up slowly so that they can integrate it in their life in a sustainable way, and then also like see what works for them so that they don't start progesterone and get agitated like me, and then they're fighting with their wife or something like that.
Right. It happens all the time, especially even just with women. I feel the same. You know, I feel like there's a lot of things like gut health that need to be addressed first. Xenenolone instead of xenoestrogen. Xenenolone. Father of all xenos. Okay, interesting. Okay, I think BPH and prostatitis is along the same lines as the cancer question and the...
I do want to touch on that specifically.
Okay.
I think that a lot of the prostatitis and some of the prostate symptoms may actually be a function of gut issues directly. And I've had some people that I've worked with to manage that. And my targeted approach was addressing the gut directly. Now, this isn't like direct research per se, like going in PubMed. There are some articles talking about endotoxins' involvement in different cancers and things like that. So theoretically, it's feasible and possible. But from a very specific like experiential stance, the sigmoid colon and the colon in general runs literally like the lower portion of the colon and the rectum run right next to the prostate, or like right. They're all in the same spot, prostate, bladder, colon. And if you have a lot of inflammation and you have a lot of like gut issues going on in that particular area, I think that can over time lead to prostatitis symptoms or inflamed prostate type symptoms. Via because the intestine is a bit irritated, or there's dysbiosis, or the whatever food you're eating is not ideal for the system, that can bleed over to those tissues because they're right there. There's no real separation in the abdominal cavity. So that I think that that's a big piece, is getting those things, once the gut is functioning and those things start to, the colon starts to move well, and those, all of those processes start to improve, you start to see that those symptoms can abate for people. And I've seen that with quite a few clients actually. So I think that that would be a big angle in light of the branding of the podcast, but also in my personal experience around this stuff.
Well, I feel the same about endometriosis, you know, and, you know, the bowels right there, and the, you know, small intestine, everything is right there. And an endotoxin is leaking into, you know, the bloodstream, the abdominal cavity, whatever. And there you have this, these things growing. Anyway, that I think that is something that not a lot of practitioners talk about.
Well, on that directly, just on the endotoxin piece, I dropped a hint before about this, but endotoxin can directly lower your thyroid function, can directly lower your testicular function, can directly affect ovarian function. And basically, when endotoxin gets into the bloodstream, even very minuscule amounts, it triggers an inflammatory response that triggers the release of tons of these signaling molecules called cytokines. For a while, they didn't, like, in the research, they have neuroendocrine immunology, which is like the combination of understanding the interaction between the endocrine system, the immune system, and the neural system. But essentially what you see with this is that the cytokines that are released from an inflammatory response of endotoxins, so these cell signaling molecules, go and interact with the hormonal centers of the brain, the pituitary, and signal to the pituitary, hey, we have a problem going on, we have this inflammatory stimulus, and shuts things down. And so, like, in patients who are in the ICU, and this is an extreme example, but patients who are in the ICU who are dealing with euthyroid 6 syndrome and things along those lines, which is essentially like a really low T3 value and a higher reverse T3 value, and you're not really seeing a massive change in TSH, or maybe the T4 value changes a bit. In those patients, what's happening is the whole thyroid axis is deranged from the cytokine release, affecting how the hormones are interacting with the different portions of the system. So the same thing can happen with the testicular system, with the ovarian system, with the adrenal system. And what happens is it upregulates the cortisol response, upregulates the adrenal response, lowers the gonadal response, affects the thyroid response. And so it basically, like, deranges the whole system as well in a direction that you don't want. And I say deranges, but that's a par for the course response, because it's trying to deal with the stress. And you don't want to be trying to get somebody pregnant or getting pregnant if you have this inflammatory stimulus going on. So it reroutes all of the supplies towards dealing with those problems. It just, if that runs chronic, obviously that degrades the system, because the running the stress response, it's only supposed to be a short-term thing. And if it runs long-term, it starts to degrade these other systems as it shuts them down. So that's something to keep in mind is, and there is papers in PubMed, there is a theory about endotoxin causing hypogonadism. I think it's, the title is like, it's an acronym is GELDing. I forget the specific of the acronym, but it's like the endotoxin theory of like hypogonadism or something along those lines.
Wow. Well, yeah. My mentor used to say, fix the gut, fix the thyroid. And so I never really used to even talk about thyroid. I never used to do any, I would say it's a gut thing. And I'm also blown away by, no wonder TBIs are so bad for hormones. Like Brian Thomas was on my show the other day, and he kind of made that a big point as well, but it really is a big deal. Like, you know, if you have a brain trauma and you have your pituitary impacted in any way, gosh, I mean, where does FSH and LSH, is it produced in the pituitary or?
They're producing the pituitary. On a note on that, I worked on a traumatic brain injury unit for 2 years and a spinal cord injury unit.
Wow.
And when you have patients who have serious brain injuries, like the patient I was working with were complete comatose, like couldn't even open their eyes, don't respond to any commands. They have a trach, they can't breathe by themselves. They can't pee. They can't go to the bathroom. They can't eat. Like, we're doing everything for them. They cannot do anything. When they in the initial stages of the injury, when their brain is quite inflamed and there's maybe damage to the hypothalamus, you get this process, the cliche term for it that we call is storming. But essentially what would happen is their hypothalamus would just start going to hyperdrive, and they would just get fevers, like super high fevers, super high blood pressure. You would see their heart rate spike, and then you would start to see that they would be like sweating and they'd be shaking, and it would just stop. It would like happen and then it would just stop. And you would have those problems who then like come on and off. So there's like, when those areas of the brain get damaged, it's really rough. Even I had one patient one time, actually, I turned him, you have to turn them every 2 hours so they don't get bed sores, because they can die from those bed sores. So we turned him, and basically I had him turn so that his feet were on one side and his body was still kind of straight because he was on the, he was kind of the other way. And when I turned him, I must have moved his body in a way that he didn't like. And he sweat just on one side of his body. And there's like a line down the center and the sweat was only on one side.
Wow.
And just very weird nervous system things happen with those damage. So I, based on his injury and what he had happen, I assume that some of the nerves that control the different dermatomes, which are the different areas of the skin that the nervous system innervates, had been in an uncomfortable position for him. And then that led to the sweating. And he also, you know, he started to like move uncomfortably and his heart rate and his blood pressure and things changed. So then I had to switch him back. When you work in those types of environments, you get used to seeing like if you do certain things or if something's not how the how their body likes it, you have to adjust it so they don't get those responses. Yeah. Same thing with spinal cord patients.
Wow. God bless you guys. I mean, I could not, I would be like, oh my God, what have I done? It kind of sounds like with all that damage and inflammation, it's almost like the brain is trying to come back online and it's doing, it's like spazzing out neurosynapses and things are trying to like, you know, like a robot. It's weird. That's a very interesting thing.
When you have damage to the brain or you damage the spinal cord, like any type of injury, you have inflammation. The problem is when you first have inflammation, particularly with the neurons, there's different areas. There's they call it the umbra and then the penumbra. So there's the area where it's actually damaged in the brain, like you've bled in there or you have the axons have been sheared. And then essentially like that's the really damaged area. And then out of that area, you have like the other, you have an area where there's a bunch of inflammation around. And that area will actually recover if things are done appropriately, even though this other area is damaged. But while that's all inflamed, all those neurons are not working because when the tissues are inflamed anywhere in the body, the inflammatory response and the environment that gets created in those tissues impairs the metabolic functions and processes of all the tissues nearby because it just swells and you have all these mediators and they're not drained appropriately. And the nervous system is hypersensitive to those types of things. So what you see with the traumatic brain injury patients and the spinal cord patients or even stroke patients is that their initial symptoms are way worse most times than what they'll wind up with. But it takes time for the nervous system to kind of chill out. And those areas, that other area that's not fully destroyed, but as damaged from the local inflammation, to get some recovery back. And then you start to see some functions start to come back. Wow. And that is the nervous system, as you kind of said, like trying to get back into the swing of things. Plus, when you have a damaged area, the other neurons in the brain will start to learn how to do these other things if you prompt them. So that's another thing with like stroke patients. If you have a stroke and you don't prompt them to do things, then they won't learn and develop the new pathways. So there's a lot in with that, but
Talking about that. That's so interesting. So just a personal question, if you don't mind, you know, with your history, with your gallbladder and your gut stuff as a youngster, and then becoming a nurse and be working in these really like traumatic scenarios, do you feel like you have any kind of like first responder PTSD from that? Like, do you feel like it has affected your cortisol levels and you've had to manage your stress because of it?
So I actually, you get so accustomed to it that for me, I have a different personality in the hospital because there's a lot of other pressures besides like what's going on with the patients, because I have to like, I can't have any of the current belief system that I function under and my understanding of different things don't apply in the hospital. There's protocols that I have to follow regardless of, you know, how I think about things. And there's a hierarchy that has to be maintained. So when I'm in the hospital, I know I'm functioning within a particular role and I understand that. And I function in that particular role and I do things to my best of my ability. And then as far as managing the stress, there is an element of, I don't know, I depersonalize from it. So while I'm in the hospital, I have a completely different personality. The way I deal with the stress is I'm just like, I just get it done. I just do what I have to do and I don't even think about it. And the other thing is I'm so used to some of those things, or I was at least, because I haven't been in for a couple of months, that like it got to a point where I would have a patient who had a heart attack or who was about to die, or I had to resuscitate and I wasn't in stress. Like, I wasn't stressed by it anymore. I would just do what I have to do. And it was just kind of like another day on the job. And amazing. We would just do what we had to do, bring them to the ICU. Or if somebody passed for whatever reasons were, mm-hmm. we do the protocol that we have to follow. And then we set up the room again, because somebody's going to come in that same shift. And you just have to, like, it, the job calls for it. So you basically adapt. Another thing that I want to mention here directly is that I always made sure I had enough food and enough fuel ready so I can deal with the stress. So I always had juice. I always had snacks and things like that, because I would start to feel it more if I wasn't like eating enough. Mm-hmm. So when I made, as long as I ate enough, I would usually was able to, I'd have the event. I wouldn't be like super stressed out, but I would have the fight or flight response, because you have to mobilize really fast. If your patient has a stroke, like you have to go right away to go solve the problem. Or if they're not breathing or they start to decline, like it's a immediate thing. So you mobilize, but you kind of get used to that. And it definitely took a toll on my health. But I think for me, I developed a separate personality and I kind of depersonalized from the stress and just like saw it as this is what I have to do. And I just do it. So yeah. I don't know if that answers appropriately.
No, it totally does. And that's what I hear a lot. You know, I have like the sweetest nurse that came on that was working in a like a massive trauma unit for a long time. And in the worst scenarios. And she's just the sweetest person. You would never, I'm like, how do you, and she would tell me about the things she would see and do. And I'm like, how? Same. She said the same. And I just wonder if on a somatic level, you're still managing that stuff, you know, like a nervous system level, you're unable to, or not unable, but some part of you has to deal with that.
Different people, I think, handle it differently. And I think in the hospital, because of like the tone and the way things are set up, and the other thing I see with people in general is like, I think humans are extremely adaptable. So you will start to just, even for me, like I was working during the pandemic, like 60 hours a week, it would kill me. But at a certain point, like I just did it and I just got into the rhythm and I just went, and it was just like, it's just what I had to do. And then now when I look back at it, about what I did, like while I was in it, I would wake up, it'd be like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I just worked the day before and then go to sleep till 12 or 1, and it was my like third day in a row or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I would just be like, this sucks. Yeah. And then, but when I look back at it, I don't even remember any of the, like, I don't remember being uncomfortable. It's just like a minor blip inside my memory. And when I did it a couple times, I realized that like once I'm through it, I'm not even going to know what I did. Like I have the experiences of things that I did. The other thing is the stuff interests me. So while I'm in the hospital and I'm dealing with things, like my wheels are turning around, like if a patient had a serious situation, my wheels are turning around what's going on and what I have to do. And mm-hmm. I kind of liked, not that the person was in a bad spot, but I liked figuring out the puzzle and solving the pieces, going through the labs and catching it before it even happened. Mm-hmm. And then working with a doctor to create a strategy so that they don't go down the tubes or they move in this direction or that direction. So once I got adept as a nurse, I was able to prevent most problems from getting there, because I could tell, you get to a point, like as I was saying, like you have a certain type of patient, you have a spinal cord patient, you have a brain injury patient, you have a patient with neurologic issues, you have a psych patient. There's very minor tells that you can see with patients, and you know that something's not right and that they're going in the wrong direction, and it's not even entirely empirical. So first is like an intuitive thing. Yeah. And then you go and find the empirical data to support this. You start looking at trends in labs, and you start looking at trends in their vitals and things like that and their function. And then you start leaving the doctor a little bit of some clues, like, hey doc, X, Y, and Z is going on. And then eventually they're like, oh, let's go and do this. And it's like, okay, let's go and do this.
Nice.
And so you get to that point. And for me, I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed seeing, like, saving some like people. Like it depends. Yeah. I guess it depends on how you frame it as well.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's different from like an accident happening outside and I run out there and I see something and I'm trying to help, where you're in an environment where you know these emergencies are going to come today and you have to deal with them. And so it's a different, you know, you get,
well, you know
to
what
that.
To do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have the resources. That's the difference. Like if I'm in an ICU unit and I know that my patient is going to like is on the borderline of dying, I have all the resources. I have lines in them. I have multiple ports. that I can put all these different medications in and titrate the doses. And then I have access to dialysis. I have access to their airway. I have access to their feeding. I have access to tons of different things. Like, I've had patients whose heart rates absolutely plummeted and I couldn't get them back up. And it's like, I have atropine. So I can just push atropine and bring their heart rate right back up. And I'll just keep pushing atropine until we get them to the place that they need to be or figure out what's going on. Or I've had patients whose heart rates have run like at 160 beats per minute and they won't come down and they're in AFib or something like that. And like, I have medications, I'll just push metoprolol and it's like, it'll start to come back down. And if it doesn't work, then I'll go get this drug. If somebody's in a heart attack, you just, okay, they have a heart attack, I'll get you some oxygen, I'll get you some nitro, I'll get you some aspirin. Like, it just becomes routine. You know what you have to do.
Yeah.
And then you just go from there, you draw the labs. So like, before the doctor even orders things, it's like, these are the steps that I have to do. I go and do all the things and I send the message to the doctor. I call him like, hey, can we do X, Y, and Z? And she's like, sure. And it's like, okay, I already sent everything and organized everything here. Can I just give it before you put the order? And they're like, sure. Once you know them. So it's not scary anymore because you know what you have to do and you have the resources to deal with it.
That sounds, because I was kind of comparing it to like, you know, PTSD with someone who might be in combat or a police officer, but it's very different. I mean, yeah, they are in scenarios where they definitely have resources and weaponry and things like that, but it's totally, totally unpredictable. And that's much different, you know? Well, that's super interesting. Okay. Well, you have given me so much of your time. There is one question from Constantine that I saved and it might end up being a whole other hour, but let's see. He says, he said some specific questions on hypertension, like what increases the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. We'll leave it at that. I won't carry on with what else he says.
So the RAS system, which is what he described, the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, it's just for like the audience, it's a system that controls blood pressure by adjusting the amount of sodium that your body retains versus the potassium that you excrete, controlling the sympathetic nervous system and controlling vascular constriction. So essentially what happens is if you have low blood volume or you have like a decreased sodium concentration in the blood or something like that, this system gets upregulated. The vasculature contracts because it triggers angiotensin 2. There's like a whole process. I don't want to walk through it because I don't want to lose everyone, but it triggers this production of angiotensin 2 that causes vascular constriction. And then it triggers the release of aldosterone, which comes from the adrenal gland. And what aldosterone does is it reabsorbs the sodium, and water tends to flow with sodium, and then it lets the potassium go. And so you, like, it's a system that you need to maintain that blood volume, and the sodium helps to maintain the blood volume with the vascular constriction, because with the sodium, the water moves. So you're increasing the water inside the vascular system, or think of like a pipe, and you're making the pipe smaller. So now the blood pressure can increase. Now there's a lot of things that can actually adjust what's going on with the RAS system. So there's a couple different connections. Parathyroid hormone is another system, which is vitamin D, calcium, and magnesium oppose. Parathyroid hormone and the renin angiotensin aldosterone system are intimately interrelated. So if your calcium and magnesium, vitamin D, all that stuff is not organized, that can upregulate RAS. Another thing that can upregulate RAS is if you don't have enough sodium, your body will start to upregulate RAS. The other thing is if you have changes, if you have way too much sodium, you can see stress on the kidney and changes in the RAS system. The other thing is if you don't have adequate blood volume or you have different things going on with your electrolytes, you see changes in the RAS system. So all of these things can lead to a hypertensive response. And now something to keep in mind is the RAS system is actually not good to have elevated long-term, because the angiotensin 2 is directly damaging to the vasculature. So over time, chronically elevating the RAS system damages the vasculature. And it actually leads to heart disease. Chronic elevations of angiotensin 2 can lead to heart disease directly at multiple levels. And then it also, since the RAS system stimulates the sympathetic nervous system, with chronic elevation also damages the vasculature and also damages the cardiovascular system. And both of them cause stress on the kidney as well. So they're helpful, all of these stress systems, but this one as well is helpful to maintain adequate blood pressure, blood volume, and sodium concentrations regularly. So you have this like fine-tune adjustment, which is great. But if you chronically have problems and you're chronically upregulating it, what winds up happening, you start to damage the vasculature. You start to get a very stiff vasculature, and then the system can start to like move into overdrive. As you chronically upregulate, you're having these problems, the vasculature is getting damaged, and you need more of this system to kind of like maintain things appropriately. And so that can lead to, it can push cardiovascular disease directly. So it's actually a really important system to understand. And just as a side note, almost every single blood pressure drug that gets used to lower blood pressure is targeting some piece of the RAS system. So your angiotensin receptor blockers block angiotensin 2 from binding to its receptor. Your ACE inhibitors, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors, inhibit the enzyme that converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And then you have some things that are involved. There's these, I think there's alliscrine is what it's called, the alliscrine inhibitor. I forget the specific name, but that works directly with renin. And then you have things like metoprolol, which is a beta blocker, which blocks the beta adrenergic system. So it blocks part of the sympathetic nervous system. That controls more heart rate than blood pressure, but it can work with blood pressure. Another one would be carvedilol. So all these different drugs are working. These are the main ones that tend to get used. The other ones are like calcium channel blockers, which is like your amlodipine. Those aren't working directly on the RAS system so much, but they're working on vascular contraction. So it's still the same type of idea. The calcium is excitatory in general. So when you block a calcium channel, you allow the muscle to relax. Kind of like if you ever look at muscular physiology, they go through it all the bodybuilding textbooks or whatnot. They talk like calcium enters the muscle and then it causes contraction. Same thing happens in the vasculature. So all these drugs are geared around blocking the RAS system and then relaxing the vasculature. And that they're actually protective of, they, even though they're just symptomatic management long-term, they're very protective of the vasculature because they're blocking the negative effects of angiotensin II, of excess calcium signaling of the sympathetic nervous system. Ideally, the way you would manage this from like a natural perspective, and I actually work with people, many people currently, who have blood pressure or heart things going on, and we get their, I don't take them off their blood pressure medications, but we fix their lifestyle components, and that tends to bring their blood pressure down, and they will taper off their meds because they don't need them anymore. But you want to make sure you're lowering the parathyroid system. Calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin K, vitamin A, zinc, all those things are solidified. You want to make sure that the sodium potassium balance is appropriate. The calcium phosphorus balance is appropriate. You have adequate sodium, not in excess. You have adequate potassium. That starts to help with the RAS system. You want to make sure that you're hydrated. You want to make sure that you have covering all of the different nutrient pieces and that you're eating appropriately. You don't have endotoxin coming in from the gut. You don't have inorganic phosphate additives to foods coming in. You want to make sure you don't have excessive sodium intake from processed foods. All of these types of things will help to directly lower that system. And then metabolic syndrome, or being very overweight or dealing with obesity or something, anything like that, also tends to upregulate a variety of these different symptoms or systems. So addressing those components as well. And I've had people lose weight, change their diet, and then come off their amlodipine and their lisinopril, and within a couple months. And then just as long as they maintain those things, they're good to go. So there's a lot of, again, like a lot of it comes down to fixing the foundational pieces. I know I sound like a broken record and it's kind of boring because it's better to sell some type of specific cure. But in my experience, that's what I've seen make the biggest difference for people.
No, I think that that's important because it really shows that it's not as complicated as we try to make it. You know, it doesn't have to be all these sexy different answers. It can be just lifestyle and focusing on endotoxin and gut health types of things. Is it too general to say that when women or men both have any kind of like edema, that something's going on with the RAS system?
It's possible, that is RAS related, but it could also be related to like venous insufficiency. It could be related to things going on with the heart, like a heart failure. It could be a problem with the kidney. It could be a problem with the liver. There's
okay.
I think it would probably be too general to just say the RAS system, because there's a lot of things that can go on that could lead to swelling. And I'm visualizing the legs specifically is where people tend to find swelling.
Yeah. Yeah. And the swelling I'm talking about usually is women. It's like after 2 p.m., like towards the late afternoon and evening, it always seems like it's a water weight thing. And it's like a kidney related thing. And it's, you know, both.
Is it in the legs though? Or is it in the belly?
It's both. No, it's both legs, sometimes hands, but usually, you know, legs, feet. But also my dad's got a lot of issues and it always gets worse after like later afternoon, end of day, but that's a different story, but, okay. So too general. Okay. Well, I think that is really, yeah, we covered the other stuff. Yeah. I mean, he mentioned spironolactone. This is an aldosterone antagonist.
That's what, Constantine mentioned.
Yeah, he just says drug spironolactone is an aldosterone antagonist, which acts like progesterone. He didn't state it as a question, but that was the end of what he sent me. So I'm not sure if it's a question or not.
Yeah, so the spironolactone is an aldosterone antagonist, but it also has antiandrogenic properties. So for guys, probably be careful with that one. And I don't think you have to go towards that level of therapy unless like you're having serious serious issues going on. In most situations, like, you can solve the problems if you're just having some minor swelling or something like that, you can solve the problems with the different lifestyle and dietary components. When you start introducing the drugs, you can run into some, like, you have more complexity in the system and you can run into some problems. So for men, like, spironolactone can be antiandrogenic. For women, a lot of women seem to do okay with it, but it's also diuretic. So you wind up, like, you'll just be peeing a lot on spironolactone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's what progesterone acts like that too. So it's similar in some ways. It's just a synthetic drug.
I think it may be an altered structure of progesterone to some extent. I remember reading that at one point, so I'll have to double check, but I think it may be a semi-similar structure to progesterone.
Okay. And then this is for me. You mentioned way in the beginning that there are other tissues that make aromatase. Which tissues are they?
Besides fat tissue?
I'm scared to ask.
Almost all tissues can express aromatase.
Okay. Because I'm trying to, I know I'll be a gazillionaire and I'll help so many women, including myself, if I can figure out how to stop the chin hairs. But I know there's aromatization happening in the chin and I'm like, why? If you and I could come up with a way to get rid of those chin hairs for us women, I'm telling you.
I think there's like estrogen is one component of that, but I think a lot of times, so in the ICU, I've actually seen quite a few women, like, under significant stress, grow full beards, but I think that there's a component there of the stress hormones like cortisol and then estrogen, and then maybe some component of DHEA. I haven't looked directly into the specifics, but I think it's more than just estrogen. There's like probably a couple things going on with that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was just so incredible. I really appreciate you so much and your time. I told you so, so good and helpful. And I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I wanted to let everybody know that Ona's is starting a really cool loyalty program, and it's going to be super fun, really interactive, just trying to get people to look at Ona's as not just this place to go buy progesterone, but also as a community, also to participate, and you'll get rewards for being loyal and for being part of the community, and that's really exciting. So make sure you check in with Ona's. It's not going to cross over into the other sites, the international sites, yet, but it will. In fact, that's my goal for the end of the year, is to get all of the different sites in the different countries to be synced up on every possible way. So check it all out at us.onasnatural.com. Also, I have a TikTok. I know. I don't want to hear it. Okay. But I have one. I figure it's a great social outreach to just scream gut health and hormones from the rooftops. And I want you guys to join me if you're on TikTok. I will not be lip syncing. I will not be dressing up my dog and dancing around, making up gut health songs. I'm sorry. I won't. Cut to me totally doing that. Anyway, so it's all clips from podcasts and podcasts that you've listened to, but now you can see clips from your favorite guests. 1 minute clips with nuggets of gold that you can listen to and just enjoy. I'm still working on the Mighty Network platform. It's available to join at the moment, so you're welcome to do that. It's called Healthy Gut Girls Mighty Network. Lots of big changes happening. Healthy Gut Girls website, healthygutgirl.com, is under construction. Everything is changing, and that's exciting. So join me, and thank you for listening today and listening to Mike Favorite. His information is in the show notes. Please contact him. He's a wonderful practitioner, very helpful, super reasonable. I think he's totally, totally worth the money. So do that, and we'll talk to you soon. Yeah!